Courtney thinned her lips disapprovingly. Are you really with the FBI?
Yes.
Do you really have arthritis? His jaw tightened.
Yes.
She gazed at him curiously. They don't mind?
I can fulfill the duties required of the job.
But aren't there physical tests?
I passed.
And wouldn't other agents worry about being partnered with someone who...
I like to think that my sparkling personality more than compensates for such concerns.
Melanie rolled her eyes. So what do you do?
White-collar crimes.
Like fraud cases, banking, money laundering.
There you go. The glamorous life.
I see. She gazed at him levelly, and he suddenly saw the killer instinct spring to life in her eyes. So that story about how you were a cop and then got arthritis, that was just a load of crap designed to earn my sympathy and make me easier to manipulate, wasn't it?
I needed a credible reason for you to let me help.
Why not the truth? Or are agents famous for lying as well?
Yes, ma'am, he said in a steely voice. We sure as hell are.
She leaned closer. What about Detective Cheney? Bureau as well?
Yes.
And the whole display of bagging the scene in my room. The candles, the toy horse, the questions you made me suffer through.
Bags are at the crime labs. Information is being processed. It's a real investigation, dammit. I am trying to help you.
She nearly laughed in his face. Then tell me what you were doing at my house, agent. Finally give it to me straight. David took another bite of pizza. Then he helped himself to a drink.
I was investigating Dr. William Sheffield,
he said, gambling that William's betrayal would have cost him Melanie's loyalty.
His bingo problem has led him to take loans from some very questionable sources and gained our interest.
Melanie looked suspicious. Then how did you end up following me?
You have a history with the man. I couldn't be sure what your exact involvement with him might still be. Then you left the party with someone who obviously didn't belong.
You thought I was making a payment for William? Oh, please. I wouldn't give him water in a desert.
Of course.
Melanie sat back. He supposed he'd passed round one because the intensity had drained from her face. Now she looked confused, then troubled. If William was your subject, why get involved in my case?
I think your life is in danger.
I think you're right, but why?
I started researching Russell Lee Holmes. I also requested the Megan Stokes case file just out of curiosity. I haven't received the full case file yet, but I've gotten to read enough newspaper accounts to realize that there are a lot of unanswered questions about Megan Stokes. For example, did you know that Russell Lee was never convicted of murdering Megan Stokes?
What?
He confessed only after he was already convicted of 6 counts of first-degree murder. The police never made the case because they never had any physical evidence tying him to the crime. Your brother is right. That horse, that scrap of fabric in your room, they were never found 25 years ago. So where did they come from? Who would still have a toy last seen with a murdered child?
Her eyes, those startling blue-gray eyes, went saucer-wide. You think someone else murdered Megan Stokes?
Maybe. Maybe not.
He shrugged. But then his hunch got the best of him again. He leaned forward.
There was a ransom demand in Megan's case. Did you know that? Russell Lee didn't do that with anyone else, and it doesn't fit with him or his M.O. How would an illiterate, uneducated man fashion a ransom note? That alone suggests that either it wasn't him, or there was someone else involved. An accomplice. Maybe someone close to the family who would know its schedule.
You think someone in my family helped Russell Lee Holmes kidnap and murder Megan Stokes?
I think something really bad happened 25 years ago, and it wasn't the fault of Russell Lee Holmes. That's what I think.
Melanie looked like she was going to hit him, and then for a minute she simply looked scared. She picked up her soda and took a long sip, her hands shaking. David got up and cleared the pizza box from the table. When he sat back down, she'd composed herself once more. Her face still pale, but her shoulders square and her expression resolute. She said, All right, agent. Tell me your theory. Tell me exactly what you think is going on. So he did.
Something bad happened 25 years ago to Megan Stokes. Something that involved more than Russell Lee Holmes. That's why the police never found more physical evidence. That's why it's possible that Megan Stokes's toy and dress fabric appeared in your room. And whatever it is that occurred, it involved your family and friends. For 25 years, they've kept quiet. They let Russell Lee Holmes go to the execution chamber and got on with their lives. But now someone else has entered the picture. Someone who's suddenly shaking things up. This person calls Larry Digger with a tip on how he can finally find Russell Lee Holmes's child. This person creates the altar in your room, sending a message about you trying to replace Megan. This person is also sending notes.
What notes? David hesitated, forgetting she hadn't known and worried he'd just tripped himself up.
Your father got a note.
When?
At the party. After you had your migraine. I overheard your father and Jamie O'Donnell talking. Your father said he found a note on his car. It said the same thing Larry Digger's call said. You get what you deserve.
Melanie was staring at him incredulously.
Your father also knew Larry Digger was in town,
David continued rapidly.
He mentioned it to O'Donnell, who said that someone named Annie was getting phone calls. Now who do you think Annie is?
Ann Margaret? You think he means Ann Margaret?
She's from Texas, just like the rest of them. Now we know your father knows something, and O'Donnell knows something, and Ann Margaret knows something. Who else is from Texas? And who else is talking about receiving notes?
William, she whispered.
There you go. That just leaves your brother and your mom. Your brother seemed as shocked as you were about the altar in your room. But what about your mom? Notice anything unusual with her?
Melanie sighed. David took that for a yes. Last night, she came home late, nearly midnight. She said she'd been to a bar, told me how much I meant to her, but I could tell she wasn't actually saying what had rattled her so much. And she was speaking too urgently, as if it was suddenly extremely important I understand how much she cared about me. You know, the way someone might speak if they thought something bad was about to happen. Something final. David nodded.
So there's theory number one. Something more happened to Megan Stokes. It involves all of your family in one way or another. And somebody else knows now. This person is rattling everyone's chains, bringing out all the skeletons. Which brings us to theory number two,
he said quietly.
You are theory number two. Whatever happened 25 years ago, you hold the key.
My amnesia. The lost 9 years.
Exactly. Larry Digger couldn't find Russell Lee Holmes' wife on his own, but he was betting you could help him. If we assume that you are Russell Lee Holmes' child, think of what could be locked up in your mind. Certainly someone seems to believe you know something important, hence the scented candles and objects you might know in your room put there to trigger a reaction.
But I didn't remember anything clearly.
Not yet, but you might. Therefore, you, like Larry Digger, have become a threat.
Larry Digger was getting too close, Melanie said slowly, filling in the pieces. He honestly did have a lead. He was making progress. So someone, still trying to cover tracks, orders him killed. I might remember, so I'm a target too. But that makes no sense. If someone is pushing people to get at the truth, why order assassinations on Larry Digger and myself?
It's not the same person who ordered Larry Digger and you shot. It's someone else. This person wants the truth exposed, but for whatever reason, can't just announce it on his own. Maybe he has no credibility. Maybe he's ashamed, mentally disturbed, I don't know. So he's trying to get at things in an underhanded way. However, he's also scaring the shit out of everybody. Think about it. Your family and friends have done very well for themselves. If the truth about the past came out now.
He let the words trail off meaningfully, and once again Melanie understood. You think someone I know hired that hitman? Hired the hitman to kill Larry Digger, swipe his research, and eliminate me as well. Extinguish whatever clues might be locked in my mind. Erase once and for all any trace of what happened to Megan Stokes. Christ. Melanie grew silent, grew haggard. She whispered. It's a war, isn't it? Someone is trying to expose a secret no one else wants exposed. And I'm just the person in the middle. The adopted child who might hold the key to the truth behind a little girl's 25-year-old murder. Oh, Jesus Christ, at this point, whatever is in my head, I don't want to know.
I don't think you'll have a choice.
I always have a choice, she said firmly. She got up from the table, wiped it, washed her hands, paced, and sat down. I probably am the child of Russell Lee Holmes, she murmured. The memories of the shack, the notes.
We could look at having Holmes's body exhumed and do a DNA test. That would resolve it once and for all.
She nodded absently. There are just so many inconsistencies. Why would my parents knowingly adopt Russell Lee's child?
Maybe they don't know. Maybe Jamie O'Donnell arranged it.
How? By dumping me at a hospital and assuming Patricia and Harper Stokes would magically adopt me?
Whose idea was it to adopt you, Melanie? Did they ever tell you who suggested it first?
My mother, she said instantly. She and I, we just sort of clicked.
There you go. And it wasn't a random dumping. Your father did work there and was in the ER. Seems a fair bet that he'd hear about you, come see you for himself. Maybe bring his vulnerable wife, who was hungering for a little girl.
Still leaving a lot to chance, Melanie muttered.
Fine. Spin it the other way. Your parents did know you were the daughter of Russell Lee Holmes. They agreed to adopt you for reasons we still don't understand, and provisions were made. The night Russell Lee was executed, you're dropped off at the hospital where Harper Stokes just happened to be on duty while the rest of his family was in Texas watching an execution you would think he'd also want to see.
He paused.
Larry Digger had a point about the coincidences. One or two is happenstance. But three or four?
Melanie's gaze dropped to the table. She rapped on it with her fingers many times. But then she looked up, and there was a clearness in her eyes David hadn't expected. It nailed him in the solar plexus, made him conscious of her golden hair and citrusy perfume and those haunting eyes. She said quietly, steadily. But even then, I still don't believe it, David. I don't. My parents didn't just give me a home. They've been good parents. Not reluctant, not grudging. Whatever I've needed, whatever I've desired, they've given it to me. If you assumed they were in on it, whatever it might be, wouldn't they be resentful? Wouldn't human nature dictate that every time they saw me, they saw the man who killed their daughter? I don't care what that damn altar was trying to imply. I'm not a second-rate daughter. My parents have never let me be a second-rate daughter. That's the kind of people they are, David. That's my family. It must be relevant that I love them so much and they love me.
Hey, family is family, he tried. Sure you care.
Somewhere out there, I have a birth mother, Melanie interrupted. I have a real name, a real birthday. If you believe Larry Digger, I could be on the verge of what every adopted child dreams about, discovering her birth parents. But I don't care. I'd give it all up, David, just to have my family back the way it was. I love them. I have always loved them. I will always love them. That is how I feel about my family. David didn't answer right away. Faced with Melanie's earnestness, a trait he himself lacked, he studied the floor and the scuff marks made from all the long nights he'd spent pacing it.
Loving wives take home abusive husbands all the time, he said finally, quietly. They get strangled for their trouble. Loving parents bail their troubled kids out of jail and give them a second chance. Then they take a bullet to the head while they're sleeping one night. Love doesn't have anything to do with it in the end. It can't save a person's life. Just ask Megan. I'm sure she loved your parents, too.
He strode to the bedroom door, intent on grabbing his duffel bag, but Melanie caught his arm. He stopped, but didn't look at her. He didn't want to see tears on her pale cheeks. For all his big speech, he wouldn't be able to handle that, and he knew it. He suddenly hated the fact that he always sounded so harsh.
I gotta pack a bag, he grumbled. We should go.
and she whispered, "My family is all I have, David. Please don't take them away from me. Please."
He pulled his arm free and walked away. 14. After David disappeared into his bedroom, pointedly closing the door behind him, Melanie wandered the living room, rubbing her arms. Ever since the shooting of Larry Digger, she couldn't seem to get warm. Now her head was filled with conflicting images. Her big, burly godfather whom she adored. Her strong, silent dad who'd always been there for her. Her fragile, tremulous mom, whom she loved beyond reason. Brian, her hero, and Margaret, her friend. A person capable of harming Megan Stokes. A 25-year-old cover-up. She tried to tell herself it was all a crazy mistake. Logic gone awry. Conspiracy theory run amok. But her mind was too rational for her own good. She couldn't dismiss the altar and the pieces of evidence in her room. She couldn't dismiss Larry Digger's body and the shooter who'd aimed right at her. She couldn't dismiss David's point that the police had never found any physical evidence tying Russell Lee Holmes to Megan Stokes. Melanie didn't know what to do. She was tired, frustrated, and overwhelmed. She longed desperately for the comfort of her own home, and for the first time feared it as well. She wanted to hear her mother's reassuring voice. She had no idea what she would say. She wanted her family. She was beginning to feel as if they were all strangers. What were they so afraid of? 9 o'clock on a Monday night. Melanie didn't have answers, so she took the low road and sought distraction instead. David's apartment boasted a bookshelf crammed full of cheap metal trophies. One had a plastic guy on top that seemed to be pointing a gun. The dust-covered brass plate declared the owner to be the junior champion, 22 target pistol, 25 feet. Tucked between it and six others were a collection of well-thumbed gun magazines and patches and bars still in their wrappers. Marksman, distinguished expert, one said. So David Riggs was not only a loner, but a gun aficionado as well. That didn't surprise her. But the largest trophy turned out not to have a thing to do with guns. It was pushed all the way in the back, as if David couldn't decide whether to be proud of it or not. A baseball player was poised on top, bat positioned on its dusty shoulder. The brass plate at the bottom was worn, as if thumbed over and over again. The letters faintly proclaimed, "Mass All-Star Champion." She moved on to the picture of the baseball player on the wall. Shoeless Joe Jackson was scrawled across the lower right-hand corner. The name sounded vaguely familiar to her. She looked at the picture of Fenway Park, then returned to the bookshelf and found a scrapbook. The first picture was old, the edges crinkled, the color yellowed. The woman was young, dark hair neatly curled under at her shoulders, warm, intelligent gaze looking straight into the camera. David's mother, Melanie realized. She had passed on her rich hazel eyes to her son. She looked like a strong, sensible woman, the kind who ran a tight ship. She disappeared from the scrapbook much too soon. Split-level ranch house with its olive-colored carpet and brown linoleum disappeared as well, the family portraits becoming a thing of the past. David's mother died, and a scrapbook became about baseball. Here was David Riggs, age 8 and decked out in a Little League uniform. Here was 10-year-old David with his whole team. Here was David with Stephen and Bobby Riggs posed on a baseball diamond. Here was Bobby Riggs tossing balls to his son, who were now taller, leaner. Certificates appeared in the scrapbook, announcing pitching achievements. First no-hitter, lowest number of hits allowed in a season, best ERA. Then came the newspaper articles. Promising young pitcher in Woburn. Woburn High grooming best ever. The major league recruiters arrive in town. All know they are eyeing the Riggs boy. And the pictures. Pictures of Special Agent David Riggs Melanie would not have thought possible. No grim expression or lined face. He beamed in color photos, posing enthusiastically with his glove, then in mid-pitch. He played with the camera. He winked at the crowd. He was the hometown hero, and the photographs documented it diligently. Young David Riggs, who was going to go to the pros and make Woburn proud. Young David Riggs,
arching up on the pitcher's mound to catch a ball, his face so earnest, so intent. Next shot. The ball in his glove, his body descending from the sky and his face beaming with joy. Next shot. David holding up the ball, showing it to his father, who was screaming on the sidelines. "For you, Dad," his expression announced. And Melanie could read Bobby Riggs's reply and his exalted look, his parted lips. "That's my boy," the father was screaming. "That's my boy." Melanie hastily closed the scrapbook. She had intruded too far. These were private photos of a private time that had come and gone. This was David with his family, and David with baseball, which seemed to be an even more personal relationship. She should have let it be. Everyone deserved their walls. Of course, she opened the scrapbook and looked again. God, he was magnificent when he was happy. The passion, the fire. She could see how that would make him a good federal agent. But as a baseball player, wow. And then Melanie entertained the worst of all female fantasies. She wondered if she could make him smile like that. If she could fill his eyes with such primitive joy. If she could heal a man and make him feel whole. This time she closed the scrapbook more firmly, then tucked it back in its place on the bookshelf. The images were emblazoned in her mind. She did her best to tuck them away as well. The bedroom door was still closed. She passed by closely enough to realize that he was talking in there. Phone call. To whom? Then she had another thought. Whatever he was saying, it probably had to do with her case, which was her life, which was her business, damn it. Melanie cupped her ear against the wood. She could hear every word. David was giving someone a thorough dressing down.
"Sheffield did not just stay home all night, damn it. He told Melanie's dad he won last night, which means he was out gambling. And apparently, while he was out gambling, someone broke into his house. We're not even sure if anything was taken, but they left a note. Now I want to know what the note said." "Yeah, Cheney. Do you understand now why sticking to your target is so important? Is this getting through to you yet? Just because people go home sick doesn't mean they stay home sick. Look, I wasn't sure what I thought of this either in the beginning. The case did seem far-fetched, but we've moved way beyond coincidence at this point. We know Harper Stokes got a note. Melanie believes her mother may have also gotten a note. Now, I can't be sure, but I'm willing to believe someone played a game at Sheffield's house as well. We need to know exactly what happened there." "No, don't break into his house. Go through his trash. It's much simpler." "Okay, it's also messier, but that's the glamorous life. Sheffield works tonight, right?" "Yes, I want you on his tail. And stick this time, even at work." "I'm getting very curious about the hospital angle. So far, our anonymous tipster seems to know exactly what he's talking about. So we may have much more of a fraud case than we thought."
Yeah, I know you don't know anything. God, they gotta start getting you guys more training.
Well, do you have a pen and paper? I'll give you a lesson for the day."
"Okay. Pretend for a moment that our tipster is correct, and they are installing pacemakers in healthy patients. Now, no single doctor or healthcare professional, no matter how brilliant, can summarily recommend a pacemaker. A cardiologist would have an opinion. The cardiac surgeon, too. Then there's the ER docs who admitted the case, the nurses who attended the patient, and the anesthesiologist who would be monitoring all the patient's vitals and administering meds during surgery. All these people examine the patient, update the chart, and know what is going on. And that's assuming the patient never asked for a second opinion. Lots of people do, which means a whole new round of doctors reading charts and offering opinions. So first off, it can't be as simple as faking a chart or misdiagnosing. Hospitals are set up exactly so that kind of situation can't happen. Given that, our suspects are going to have to find someone who at least exhibits symptomology. Probably a patient who comes into the ER as a chest pain rule out MI admit, which means a person suffering from chest pains that they want to make sure isn't a myocardial infarction. A heart attack, Cheney. Myocardial infarction equals heart attack. Now, following protocol, most ERs will slap an EKG on the patient, snap a chest X-ray, as well as draw 6 to 7 vials of blood to test for cardiac enzymes. But some of these enzymes can take 12 to 36 hours to show up. So even if the chest X-ray is clear and the EKG good, a hospital will generally keep the patient for a day or so for observation, particularly if there is a history of heart problems in the family and the person appears at risk, overweight, high blood pressure, and so on. Now,
City General has a notoriously aggressive cath lab, so their ER docs also send the patient to the cath lab to shoot the coronary. Check for blocked arteries. In the cath lab, they have to feed a catheter through the femoral artery to inject the patient with dye. They'll heavily sedate the patient for the process, then send the patient to ICU for recovery and monitoring. They're also going to keep the patient under sedation because they don't want him or her to wake up in the middle of the night and pull out the catheter. So that gives us our first opportunity for nefarious deeds right there. At night in the ICU, the nursing staff is generally spread thin and focusing on the more critical cases. You have a recovery patient who is drugged and certainly not going to notice what's what. Someone could easily slip into a room, inject a patient with a drug or tamper with the EKG, and probably escape with no one the wiser. Ask around, Chaney. Have people seen Dr. Sheffield roaming the ICU a lot? That might tell us something right there. No, I don't completely understand what healthcare fraud has to do with Megan Stokes. Only that our tipster seems to know more than we do. Anything back from the lab yet? Two types of blood? Really? Jesus. David sighed. This case just gets weirder and weirder. Other findings? Yeah, I know it's too soon. I'm being an optimist. Okay. Have them do a DNA test. I imagine one kind of blood is probably Megan Stokes. As for the other, I haven't a clue. Has the Megan Stokes case file arrived from the Houston field office yet? What do you mean they said the case file is unavailable? It's a 25-year-old closed file. It's got to be sitting in the archives. A case file can't just be out. The Bureau isn't a library, for God's sake. Shit. Someone is yanking our chain. Okay, what about the Houston PD? Did they fax over their case file? Uh-huh. Give me a rundown. Life insurance. On two children. $1 million apiece. Shit. What kind of parents insure their children for $1 million? Then again, it does explain a townhouse on Beacon Street. No evidence from Megan ever found? Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, when I get to the hotel tonight, I'll give you another call and have you fax the file over. Don't worry about Larimore. I'm the lead agent, so I'll take the heat. Most likely he'll chew my ass tomorrow morning sharp. Then we'll all get on with our lives. You all set with Sheffield tonight in the ICU? I know you're tired, Chaney. So am I. Unfortunately, whoever the hell is doing this seems to be in a rush to make up for lost time. We had Larry Digger showing up on Saturday, the altar assembled for Sunday, and a paid assassin appearing on Monday. God knows what's happening right now as we speak. We're just going to have to deal for a bit. I'm watching Melanie Stokes tonight. I know. I get all the great jobs. Enjoy tagging Sheffield. Bye-bye. Melanie scurried for the sofa. The bedroom door swung promptly open, and David came striding into the room, scowling and looking preoccupied. The lab hasn't had enough time for an in-depth analysis, he stated without preamble. But we do know there are two types of blood on the scrap of blue fabric in your room. They'll run some more tests.
Melanie nodded. David didn't offer anything more. He was standing in the middle of the room with his hands on his hips and his mind 1 million miles away. He was tired, too, Melanie realized. There were fresh lines around his mouth and at the corners of his eyes. His skin was drawn too tight, making him look especially harsh and stern. He crossed the room to his answering machine. The message light was blinking, and he punched play. Then he strode back into his room for his duffel bag while the tape rewound. He just returned to the living room when the first message began.
Hello, David, this is your dad. Still haven't heard from you. I guess the Bureau is keeping you busy. I'm reading now about some new methods for accurizing. Want to bring your Beretta in? I have some things I want to try out.
Bobby Riggs' voice petered out awkwardly. Melanie could hear the man swallow.
Oh, well. Just thought I'd see if you were in. No big deal. Give me a call if you have a chance. I got tickets to the Red Sox, or... Aw, hell. It's been a while, David. Just call sometime.
Melanie looked at David. His face was still a mask. The next voice came on.
Riggs, check your goddamn voicemail. I have a message that you've been involved in a shooting. I got a Boston police chief talking to me about homicide. What the hell happened to eyes and ears only, Riggs? And what happened to procedure? When one of my agents discharges his weapon, I do not expect to hear about it from Boston PD. In case you're still ignoring the voicemail, I want you in my office 0700 tomorrow. And bring a damn report with you.
The call ended abruptly. David merely smiled.
That was my boss, he said easily. Guess I won't be getting that corner office after all.
A clipped, professional voice came over the tape.
This is Supervisory Special Agent Pierce Quincy from Quantico. Sorry to call you at home, Agent Riggs, but I was notified today by the Houston field office that you were requesting the Megan Stokes case file. I would like to know why you are requesting this particular case file. You can contact me at...
He rattled off the number. Melanie looked sharply at David, who had gone perfectly still.
Shit,
he said after a moment, belatedly scribbling down the phone number.
What the hell is this all about?
He said you requested the file.
Well, no kidding. But first Houston tells me the file is unavailable. Now I have Quantico calling me at home to follow up on my request in less than 24 hours. Why does everyone suddenly care so much about a closed case file? And especially why Quincy?
Melanie looked at him blankly. Would you like to translate for those of us who are merely personally at risk and not the trained professional? David shook his head. He still looked confused. Actually, he appeared nervous. He finally walked into the kitchen, grabbed a bag of frozen carrots, and slapped it onto his lower back.
You haven't heard the name? He was involved in the Jim Beckett case last fall.
The serial killer who escaped from Walpole? Melanie had heard of that case. There was probably no one in New England who hadn't locked their doors and windows when the former police officer and killer of 10 women had broken out of Walpole. In his brief time of freedom, Beckett had managed to cut a broad, violent swath. She didn't even remember how many people he had killed in the end. It had been a lot.
Quincy did the original profile, David muttered. Served as the FBI consultant when the case team reassembled and was instrumental in plotting strategy. Beckett murdered an FBI agent, you know. There was some question about her role at the time, but Quincy stated she died in the line of duty. And if Quincy says she died in the line of duty, then trust me. All the bureaucrats have her listed as dying in the line of duty. After helping catch Beckett, he's violent crimes official expert du jour and about as politically untouchable as one gets in the bureau. Basically, God himself just called about Megan Stokes.
15. Why would this expert call about Megan?
There's only one way to find out.
David held up the number. Melanie faltered. Her chin was up, her shoulders square. Some part of her wanted to be strong enough. This was her family, and she would do anything for her family. She owed it to them. The rest of her was feeling bruised and battered. She wanted the truth, but she feared it just as much. The truth did not always set you free. Sometimes it bound you to dark, bloody deeds and cost you the people you loved.
Why don't you go into the bedroom?
David suggested.
You can rest while I handle the phone call.
No, I'm ready.
You've had a long day.
It's my family, David. I want to. He was quiet for a moment, then he shrugged. But his look was different. More understanding, she thought, and that undid her a little. Heaven help her, but if David Riggs turned kind now, she would most likely fall apart. He turned away before the moment became something neither one of them was prepared to handle. He set up the speakerphone on the dining room table and they both took a seat. Though it was after hours, they got Supervisory Special Agent Pierce Quincy on the first try.
This is Special Agent David Riggs returning your call.
David hit a button on his phone base.
Just so you know, you're on speakerphone and Melanie Stokes is also in the room. Good evening, Miss Stokes,
Quincy said politely, then added to David.
Why is she part of this call? I'm in the middle of a case that concerns her,
David said tersely.
And it was for her that I requested information on Megan Stokes. Why are you involved? Isn't this a closed case? Yes, thus I was equally surprised to find a field agent from Boston requesting this information. According to your file, you work with white-collar crimes.
David tensed, and Melanie got the distinct impression she was in the middle of a pissing war where information would be doled out only in hard-to-earn pellets. As the junior agent, David got to go first.
My complete involvement in the case isn't something I want to discuss right now,
he said curtly.
But to get the ball rolling, Melanie Stokes is Harper and Patricia Stokes' adopted daughter.
Two nights ago, a reporter named Larry Digger.
The Dallas Daily reporter?
That's the one. He showed up and alleged that Ms. Stokes was the daughter of Russell Lee Holmes. Yesterday, she found a shrine at the foot of her bed. It contained one red wooden pony, presumably Megan Stokes' toy, a scrap of blue fabric, presumably from Megan Stokes' dress, and 44 gardenia-scented candles, spelling out the name Megan. Then today, Larry Digger was shot and killed. Now, why do you have the Megan Stokes file?
44 candles, Quincy murmured. Melanie could hear scratching sounds as he made notes.
Confirmation on the toy and fabric scrap? At the lab now, Brian Stokes, the brother, has made an initial ID.
Interesting.
I don't see any mention of the police ever finding the red wooden pony or the blue dress. On the other hand, many items from the other victims were recovered from Holmes's cabin.
Why do you have the file?
Down, agent, Quincy said lightly, earning a fresh scowl from David.
I'm sorry if I sounded too intense on the message, but I just started researching Russell Lee Holmes as part of an internal project to develop our intellectual capital.
What's that? Melanie whispered to David.
He's researching Russell Lee Holmes to add his profile to the violent crimes database of information.
David translated.
The Beckett case must have been something else, because the Bureau usually encourages internal projects only when they decide an agent's one wick short of a meltdown.
The more you deal in death, agent,
Quincy said quietly,
the more you learn the value of stopping and smelling the roses.
It sounded to Melanie as if the older agent spoke less out of wisdom and more out of regret. She began to like Supervisory Special Agent Quincy. He said,
Special Agent Riggs is correct. In the Violent Crimes Division, we maintain an entire database of information we've gathered from murderers, rapists, all the people you wouldn't want to invite over to your mother's for dinner. It is by analyzing and comparing these cases, these offenders, that we have been able to come up with the common traits and behavior characteristics we used to profile. As part of my project, I proposed that we go back and analyze famous historic cases. Last month, I turned to Russell Lee Holmes. Imagine my surprise when halfway through this process, I received a call about one of the files.
Do you know much about the Megan Stokes case, Miss Stokes?
Quincy asked. It's not something my family talks about.
Do you have any theories as to why Larry Digger approached you?
I was found in the hospital when I was 9. I don't have any memory of where I came from. That makes me an easy target.
We've covered this ground,
David said impatiently.
There are some reasons to believe Larry Digger's allegations. That's not why I requested the Megan Stokes file.
Then why did you request the file?
Because I'm not blind, deaf, and dumb,
David snapped.
Because I can read between the lines, and just as you've probably concluded in the last few weeks, there are a lot of reasons to doubt that Russell Lee Holmes killed Megan Stokes.
Even though she'd heard this theory once before, Melanie still found it jarring. Hundreds of miles away, however, Quincy did not seem startled.
Very good, Agent. I've spent 2 weeks trying to figure out what to do. After all, there is no statute of limitations on homicide, and I'm almost 100% certain that Russell Lee Holmes did not kill Megan Stokes.
He was innocent? Melanie asked.
I would not say he was innocent,
Quincy calmly corrected her.
I believe he did kill 6 young children. I doubt, however, that he kidnapped and murdered Megan Stokes. Russell Lee Holmes was never tried for Megan Stokes,
David reviewed.
He was convicted of killing 6 other children and confessed to Megan's murder only later, after he'd been found guilty. He made that confession to Larry Digger.
Why do you believe he made the confession?
Quincy asked David like a teacher quizzing a student.
Because he was already sentenced to death? What was one more murder?
Hold on, Melanie protested. Even if it didn't cost him anything, why would Russell Lee Holmes do someone a favor by confessing? He's not exactly a nice guy.
I don't think he did it for nothing,
David said, and for the first time he wouldn't meet her eye.
I think he may have been given an offer he couldn't refuse.
She didn't understand. They had just had this conversation. Why hadn't he said this then? What new warped theory was cooking in that head of his?
I think,
David said slowly.
We just figured out why your parents may have knowingly adopted the child of a murderer. He covers their sin.
Melanie stopped breathing.
She had the strange sensation that David's apartment was tilting, and she was plunging headlong into the abyss.
Melanie,
David asked quietly. She managed to turn her head. He was looking at her with genuine concern. It turned his eyes gold. Both gentleness and anger brought out the gold. Why had she never realized that before? She suddenly wanted him to hold her, to feel those arms around her again the way he'd done the first night, when he had carried her away from Larry Digger, and the scent of Old Spice had made her feel safe. Melanie looked down. She worked hard at getting the next breath, then the one after that. Slowly, the knot eased from her chest, the pressure easing slightly.
Why don't we take this one step at a time? Quincy said reasonably. You've drawn some interesting conclusions, Agent Riggs, but you're new at this and don't have all the information yet. Miss Stokes, are you certain you want to be part of this discussion?
Yes, she said hoarsely. Yes.
Quincy began almost gently.
In 1969, when Russell Lee Holmes kidnapped his first child, Howard Teton was just beginning to outline the techniques we call profiling. Without a framework for approaching such crimes, the local police and FBI handled the Russell Lee Holmes case merely as a murder investigation. They focused on how the crimes were committed, the modus operandi instead of why the crimes were being committed. What need was driving the killer's behavior? This is an important distinction, Ms. Stokes, for a serial killer's M.O. can change over time. Maybe he switches from binding to drugging victims, but a killer's need, control, and domination of women will not change. This is called the killer's signature. It will be the same at every single killing from the 1st to the 30th, even if everything else about the crime seems different. In 1969, however, the police did not understand this principle of a killer's signature. They mistakenly attributed a murder to Russell Lee Holmes based on a superficial M.O. Since they lacked the tools to analyze deeper, more significant issues of his pathology. Russell Lee Holmes hated poor white children. Are we clear on that?
David nodded. Melanie managed a small yes. Quincy continued.
Russell Lee Holmes never advanced beyond the 4th grade and was illiterate. He held a slew of menial jobs, was known for his nasty temper, and his last job review simply stated, he likes to spit. Most likely Russell Lee Holmes hated poor white children because a very deep, very real part of Russell Lee Holmes hated himself. And he acted upon this hatred pathologically, picking out small, vulnerable girls and boys because in the most elemental way, he was trying to destroy his own roots. Russell Lee Holmes did not suffer from a conscience. He did, however, possess a great deal of rage. Now, as an illiterate, unskilled man, Holmes could not exercise his rage in a sophisticated manner. The 6 murders were clearly blitzkrieg attacks. Holmes entered poor areas which were undoubtedly familiar to him and in which he undoubtedly blended in, and simply snatched whatever child was easiest. Later, the police identified the shack he used to perform the worst of his crimes.
It was out in the woods, wasn't it? Melanie whispered. Single room. Tightly constructed, not even a draft. The windows are dusty, though. I can't see out. And cracked halfway across. I watched the spider walk along that crack.
Ms. Stokes, Quincy said carefully. I happen to have pictures of the shack in front of me. Full-color crime photos. I'm not sure what you are describing, but Russell Lee Holmes's shack had no windows. It was a simple handmade structure, and I assure you it had plenty of drafts. Several of the floorboards even came up. Beneath them was where the police found his stash of trophies.
Melanie stilled.
It's not. I'm not picturing Russell Lee Holmes's shack.
Absolutely not.
She looked at David.
Then maybe. Maybe I wasn't there, maybe I'm not.
Or Russell Lee Holmes kept Megan someplace else. Or Russell Lee Holmes was not involved,
Quincy said.
Then why would I be in the room, seeing Megan?
Melanie addressed David.
I don't know. Maybe Megan was kept in a different location, and for some reason you were also held there. Miss Stokes,
Quincy said.
When you say you can picture Megan Stokes, what exactly do you mean?
Melanie couldn't bring herself to answer. She looked to David for assistance.
She's recently started to remember things.
That's one of the reasons we believe Larry Digger may have been telling the truth. Melanie seems to have some memories of being shut up in a one-room cabin with Megan Stokes. What else do you recall?
That's all.
But you've just started remembering, correct? Think of the images that must be in your mind. There are so many things we could learn from you, particularly about the Megan Stokes case. Would you be willing to come here? I know some expert hypnotists who could work with you.
Melanie almost laughed. Oh, yes. Everyone seems quite fascinated by the potential of my mind. Her lips twisted.
Except me, of course. Hypnotism, Ms. Stokes. In a controlled environment. I promise we'll take good care of you.
No, thank you.
Ms. Stokes.
I said no, thank you. For God's sake. It all happened 25 years ago, and I do not want to remember dying children.
Quincy was silent, probably disappointed.
Of course,
he said at last.
Then let's review what we know based upon the police notes. So Russell Lee Holmes hated poor white children. He kidnapped them. He tortured them in his private cabin. And when he was done, he strangled them with his bare hands. Another symbol of someone performing a deeply personal act of violence. He disposed of the bodies randomly, dumping them naked in ditches, drain pipes, and open fields. Again, this fulfilled his need to denigrate the children, to cast them aside as proverbial rag dolls not worthy even of protection from the elements. In short, in every act he performed, he revealed his hatred of youth, poverty, and weakness. He revealed his hatred for himself. And then we get to the Megan Stokes file. She wasn't poor,
David said.
There was a ransom demand, and her body was buried in a forest, not dumped. It was decapitated.
She was in the nanny's car, Melanie murmured. Parked in front of the nanny's mother's house. I thought that was considered a poor neighborhood.
It was a lower-income neighborhood,
Quincy said carefully.
But I would still categorize it as up from Holmes's usual hunting grounds. And then the victim profile doesn't fit. Megan was well-dressed, well-groomed. She sat in a nice car and played with an imported toy. She was bright and well-spoken. If Holmes was acting out of a primarily self-destructive act, there should have been nothing about Megan Stokes to trigger his bloodlust. There should have been nothing about her that would have reminded himself of him.
Maybe it was revenge, Melanie said. The other children he hated because they were like him. He killed Megan because she was above him.
Possible, Ms. Stokes, but not probable. That is a distinct change in motivation, and it's rare to see a change in a serial killer's pathology. Now, in some cases, a killer may snatch a different type of victim because the desired target is not available. He prefers young, 20-something blonde women, but when the bloodlust got too high, the killer settled for a 30-something brunette. But in that case, the killer's need, hurting women, was not that particular, and thus it was still fulfilled. For other killers, however, the victim profile is intrinsically tied with their signature. They don't want to just hurt women. They need to hurt loose women. So the killer would never substitute a mother of three for a prostitute, even if the mother of three was more convenient. That crime wouldn't fulfill their need. For these men, finding the right target is like falling in love. They describe spending weeks, months, years looking for the right one. They start with the physical. In Holmes's case, young, undersized, dirty, and poor. And then they simply see her. The one who moves something in their chests. The one who makes their palms perspire. And they know. This one will be their target. Russell Lee Holmes falls into this group of men, and looking at the victim profile, I am not convinced there was anything about clean, vibrant, upper-class Megan Stokes to evoke bloodlust in Russell Lee Holmes. To put it colloquially, she was not his type. There are all the other factors,
David interjected, looking at Melanie.
Such as how did an illiterate man fashion a ransom note? Excellent point, Agent,
Quincy said approvingly.
I have a copy of the ransom note in front of me. As the police argued in 1972, it is a very crude note with the words cut out of newspapers and the grammar incorrect. It was hand-delivered to the hospital where Harper Stokes worked, which was clever but simple. All of this fit their image of Russell Lee Holmes. However, if you break the note down, that argument does not hold. The words are too precisely placed for an uneducated, angry young man. There is no glue leaking from the edges, indicating a great deal of precision. Finally, there are no prints, no postmark, not even saliva used to seal the envelope. Whoever created this note was patient, intelligent, and very savvy about police procedure. None of that fits with what we know about Russell Lee Holmes.
Melanie got up and shakily ran a glass of tap water in the sink. Then why can I picture Megan in that shack? If she wasn't kidnapped by Russell Lee Holmes, why would she be there?
I'm not sure, Miss Stokes. I'm honestly very curious about your memories and what they might mean for the Megan Stokes case. My overall impression is that it was a copycat crime deliberately set up by someone who knew something of Russell Lee Holmes's activities and who set out to emulate them, not out of neurosis, but out of a rational desire to cover up his or her own crime. When Megan was kidnapped, it was already suspected that the children were kept alive and hidden away, so perhaps a shack was chosen to ensure that the crime fit as much physical evidence as possible. In 1972, that was certainly enough to fool the local police and FBI. But, as I've mentioned before, profiling takes us beyond mere physical imitation of crimes to the underlying motivations and behavior. Once again, the Megan Stokes case does not fit with Russell Lee's motivation, which brings me to the final, overwhelming factor in my mind, the disposal of her body. All of Russell Lee Holmes's victims were stripped naked and dumped, except for Megan Stokes. She was naked, but her body had been wrapped in a blanket. She was not dumped, but carefully buried. She was also mutilated, her hands and head cut off. Are you familiar with decapitation, Agent Riggs? What do you mean? Decapitation generally happens for two reasons. One is logical. The cleverer criminals, generally psychopaths who are actively seeking ways to cover their footsteps, will remove the head of their victim to make identifying the body difficult. They will also cut off hands in some cases,
David said.
But we've already established that Russell Lee Holmes isn't exactly clever or logical. So what's the second reason? Emotional. Sometimes if a murderer feels guilty about a victim, suffers remorse or shame, he will mutilate heads or hands to depersonalize the crime. Decapitation can be an indication that the victim was close to the killer.
Oh, God, Melanie said, already knowing what was coming next.
In conclusion, Quincy said quietly, the body was covered by either someone who was very careful or by someone who truly cared. The parents,
David filled in then, added almost savagely.
For the money, right? The $1 million?
Melanie looked at him, startled.
What? Harper and Patricia Stokes had $1 million life insurance policies on both of their children,
Quincy provided calmly.
In fact, before Russell Lee Holmes confessed, the police were actively investigating Harper Stokes. The 70s were a rough time for him. He had lost quite a bit of money on various speculative deals, and without that life insurance policy, he may have been forced to declare bankruptcy.
You do not murder your own child for money, Melanie shouted. Not even for $1 million. And if both of them were insured, why Megan? Why not Brian?
Oh, God. Why not Brian? She bowed her head, even more horrified. Of course, Brian had probably thought of that before. Most likely, her moody brother had spent most of the last 25 years thinking, why not me? And he had always been resentful toward their father, almost hateful. Had he known? Had he suspected? Oh, Brian.
Wouldn't you just fake the kidnapping?
She cried.
Couldn't they have just faked Megan's disappearance, held her in a shack and collected the ransom money from the bank or whatever? That would fit with what I know.
Except how would they explain the money?
David said softly.
If Harper and Patricia Stokes suddenly had $100,000, people would get suspicious. If they had lost their daughter, however, and received the life insurance, then everything was explained.
Except their daughter is dead? They wouldn't do that. I know them, David. They are my parents, and I swear to you, they couldn't do something as sick as murder their 4-year-old daughter for money.
Miss Stokes,
Quincy interjected somberly.
I know you don't want to hear this, but Based on what I've seen here, I think Megan Stokes was decapitated out of guilt. She was buried out of remorse, and she was wrapped in a blanket out of love. Miss Stokes, in only three other cases have I seen a child's body so carefully swaddled and buried. In all three of those cases, the killer turned out to be the child's mother.
Oh, God.
Serial killers do not have a need to cocoon their corpses in soft blankets. Protecting a child, however, even when it is too late, even when it is out of guilt, is a trait that is distinctly maternal. At this point, based on what I have read, I would reopen this case, Agent Riggs and Miss Stokes. I would look at the family members very carefully. I would examine everyone's motives and exactly what was going on with the family in the summer of 1972, including all friends and relatives. And I would start with Patricia Stokes.
16. The Waltham Suites was a decent hotel. The two-bedroom accommodation was decorated in shades of blue and mauve with that fake cherrywood furniture so many New England hotels favored. One bedroom was upstairs in a loft area. The other was downstairs across from the kitchenette. David placed his duffel bag in the lower bedroom, closest to the door, while Melanie roamed the living room, her complexion still the color of bone. At the drugstore by David's apartment, they'd gotten her some basic toiletries. The pharmacy chain didn't carry any clothes, so Melanie remained stuck with David's old t-shirt and oversized sweats. They made her appear small, particularly now as she stood at the dark window with her arms around her waist and her gaze focused on a moonless night. Outside, cars raced down the interstate. Headlights washed over her face briefly, illuminating her eyes.
"Well," David said at last, "what do you think?"
"It's fine." He waited for her to say something more, but she didn't. David wasn't sure what to do. Ever since the discussion with Quincy, Melanie had slid deeper and deeper inside herself. Her eyes had taken on the flat look of a war veteran, her lips compressed into a bloodless line. She'd hit the wall, he figured, and now would either bend or break. Unfortunately, he couldn't figure out which, and it was beginning to scare him. She turned on the TV. A brightly dressed anchorwoman gazed somberly at the camera while reporting, "Shots broke out in downtown Boston earlier today." Footage of the outside of the hotel filled the screen. People were gawking at the door. A few tourists were taking pictures. Little was known, and the 10-second report wrapped up without saying much of anything. Melanie turned off the TV. She picked up a magazine, flipped through it, set it down. Next, she picked up an ashtray. Her hands were trembling. Christ, she had small hands. He couldn't imagine her shut up in some shack with the likes of Russell Lee Holmes. David set his laptop down on the dining room table. He planned on working most of the night, doing more research, catching up on his paperwork. At 7 a.m. sharp, he and Chaney had to meet with Supervisory Agent Lairmore. The discussion wouldn't be pretty. Lairmore liked things neat and clean. Investigations run like paint-by-number kits. That his healthcare fraud agents were now chasing a 25-year-old homicide would not amuse him. David walked into the kitchenette, tossed the supply of vegetables into the freezer, then hesitated. His back hurt. Shit. It throbbed. He wasn't sleeping enough, and he was under stress. He was shooting guns again, and recoil always did him in. Truth of the matter was, the Bureau had done the right thing by assigning him to white-collar crime. He couldn't go racing down dark alleys in the heat of the moment. He couldn't leap tall buildings in a single bound. He did have a medical condition, and it was growing worse. His life now boiled down to three fun-filled options each night. Carrots, cauliflower, or broccoli. He went with cauliflower, stuffing two bags in the back waistband of his jeans. When he walked out of the kitchen, he looked like an idiot, and he knew it. Melanie was no longer on the couch. She'd returned to the window and had her hands pressed against the glass. There was something about her profile, haunted, stark, resigned, that sent him reeling. David had a crazy flashback. He was 9 years old, and his mother had finally come home from the hospital. She was lying on the couch in the living room with him and his dad and Stephen around her. His dad and brother were smiling rigidly. Dad had explained it to them earlier. Their mom was dying. Nothing more to be done. Now they must be strong for her. As strong could be. His mom ruffled his hair. Then she stroked Stephen's cheek as if he were still a baby. Then she looked away, her gaze steady, accepting, and so racked with pain it had sucked the breath right out of David. They were all trying to be brave for her, he'd realized at the age of 9, when really his mother was the brave one. They were trying to be heroes when she already was one. Oh God, his mother was a magnificent woman. And a heartbeat later, the cancer took her away. David snapped back to the hotel room. Grown man, not a kid. Frozen vegetables strapped to his back, that familiar ache tightening around his ribs. He wished he could stand more like a man for Melanie Stokes. God damn it.
You should get some sleep, he said tersely.
She turned toward him, her face expressionless. What are you going to do?
Work. Tomorrow I got a meeting with my boss. Then I'll follow up with Detective Jax. It'll be a busy day.
Melanie frowned. And what am I supposed to do?
Stay out of sight, of course. Relax a bit. Sit back and smell the coffee.
Sit back and smell the coffee? She arched a brow, her voice picking up, her cheeks turning red. Maybe he shouldn't have sounded so flippant. Sit back and smell the coffee. Oh, sure. In the last 2 days, I've learned I probably am the fucking child of a fucking murderer, adopted by other fucking murderers to cover their own fucking tracks. Sure, let me spend the day with Juan Valdez. That sounds fucking great.
David leaned back, then his own temper sparked. So he didn't know all the right things to say. He was just a guy, an overworked, unappreciated, sexually frustrated guy.
I'd take you to the office, he informed her coldly. But the Bureau doesn't have daycare.
Her eyes went wide. The pulse point on her neck began to pound. Her hands formed into tight fists, and the frustration ripped down her spine in a long, violent tremor. He was suddenly breathless. Melanie wanted to fight, he realized. She wanted to yell, she wanted to scream, she wanted to run. He could feel it all there, broiling, clouding her eyes. Saint Melanie, charitable Melanie, perfect daughter, perfect sister Melanie. For the first time he got it. All the little bits of her. The angry parts, the resentful parts, the fearful parts. She swallowed back down because she was the adopted daughter and she couldn't afford to make waves. She couldn't afford to be less than Megan. Shit, he suddenly wanted to kiss her. He wanted to close the space between them, take her lips, and feel all those emotions explode beneath him. Wild Melanie. Hurt Melanie. Real Melanie. Fuck, he wanted the honesty of it, and that was the biggest lie of all. I want to be alone, she said abruptly.
Still hiding. Still going to smile and pretend it's all right.
He took a step toward her. You're one to talk, she said, bringing up her chin. She was trying to look blasé, but he could tell she was pissed. Her cheeks were red and her eyes overbright. She looked gorgeous. He took another step and she shook her head. No. She said fiercely. Damn it, just no. I don't care how you look or if you smell like Old Spice. I don't care if it's been months since I've had sex. I don't care if fucking you would be a hell of a lot better than thinking about Russell Lee Holmes.
So you've thought about it.
His tone was blatantly triumphant, unforgivably smug. She looked mutinous. Of course I did. You picked me up that first day, carried me, made me feel safe. Her voice faltered. She made a wistful sound, and it lured him closer, made him hold his own breath. Then her lips thinned, and she recovered herself with a vengeance. But that wasn't real, was it, David? Not an act of kindness at all, but a federal employee doing his job. And you lied to me. I am so tired of everyone lying to me.
I did my job by covering my identity. Not all lies are created equal.
She laughed harshly. Splitting hairs. That's what it boils down to. Splitting hairs. Oh my God, my mother. She sat down on a chair. David said to hell with it and went over to her. She was stiff, resistant. He curved one arm around her, figuring if she belted him, it was his own fault. But she didn't hit him. She made a sound. The sound of surrender. Then strong, capable Melanie Stokes buried herself in his arms. Ah, Christ, she was so small, hardly made a dent against his chest. And all that silky blonde hair and the soft citrusy scent. He He did want to keep her safe. Lord help him, he wanted to be her hero. He pulled her onto his lap and rocked her against him. She did not cry. He figured she wouldn't. Instead, she fisted his sweatshirt, burying her face against his throat. He placed his cheek on the top of her head and wrapped his legs around her.
I love them, she whispered. They're my family and I love them. Is that so bad?
No, he said roughly. No.
They gave me everything I ever wanted. They played with me, they loved with me. They went to garage sales with me, for heaven's sake. The Stokeses at a garage sale. Surely that couldn't all be a lie. Surely.
I don't know. I don't.
She gripped him tighter, and a heartbeat later she murmured,
I'm 9 years old again. Waking up in the hospital with all these lines and needles sticking out of my body. And this time there is no one to bail me out, David. This time there is no one there.
Shh, he told her again and again. Shh. She started to cry. After a minute, he kissed the top of her head. Then he kissed her harder, smoothing back her hair, kissing the tears from her cheeks. And then he was kissing her neck, her forehead, the curve of her ears, anything but her mouth. He knew, they both knew, he couldn't kiss her mouth. Don't cross the line, don't cross the line. She angled her head up and he grazed the corner of her lips, the tip of her chin, the point of her nose, the dimple of her cheek.
More, she whispered. More.
So he kissed her throat, small, nuzzling kisses like they were hormone-enraged teenagers necking on the sofa. He drew her lobe between his lips and sucked. She sighed and shifted restlessly on his lap. He nipped her ear. She wriggled against his erection, and now they were both breathing very fast. Her neck. She had a long, sexy neck. Her cheeks, smooth as silk. He followed the line of her jaw, and then, as if drawn by a magnet, his lips were at the corner of her mouth again. He could feel her breath coming hard, feel her tension, the tight moment of total anticipation. A slight turn by either one of them, and the kiss would be had. Her lips beneath his mouth opening hungrily, the wonderful, satisfying flavor of Melanie Stokes. He could feel her shuddering. God, she was tearing him apart. Slowly, very slowly, David drew back. They both sighed, and it said enough. He was the agent building a case against her father. He still hadn't told her the complete truth, and he'd been raised better than that. Even if he couldn't be the baseball player his father had wanted, he could still be the man.
You all right?
He murmured after a moment. Better. Her hips were still resting against his groin. She didn't seem to mind, so neither did he. It was one of the advantages of being an adult, David thought. You really could just hold someone. He looped one long strand of her hair around his hand. She had beautiful hair. It smelled good, too. He would like to bury both his hands in it and rub until she sighed. His erection got a bit more uncomfortable and he had to shift.
You wear Old Spice?
Melanie murmured.
I didn't think anyone wore Old Spice anymore.
My dad,
he said absently, and moved on to examining the shell-like curve of her tiny ear.
You're close to him, aren't you?
Used to be.
Melanie Stokes even had pretty ears. Probably had cute toes as well, he thought.
Used to be.
She looked up at him.
Things change. They just do.
The arthritis?
Her gaze narrowed shrewdly. Is your father the same great communicator as you?
I learned it all from him.
Ah. And your mother isn't alive anymore to run interference. What a shame.
I suppose.
He'd never thought about it that way, but Melanie probably had a point.
Tell me about your mother. She murmured intently. Tell me what it was like to grow up with people you knew were your parents and would always love you.
David couldn't answer right away. The pain beneath her words tightened his throat too much. She said,
Please.
I don't know.
I don't remember much. You know, kids, you inherit the world and you take it for granted.
Did your mom bake cookies? When I was in the hospital, I always imagined a mom in a white ruffled apron baking chocolate chip cookies. I don't know why that image was so strong for me.
Yeah. My mom baked cookies. Chocolate chip, oatmeal. Sugar cookies with green frosting for St. Patrick's Day. God, I haven't thought of that in a while.
He rubbed his forehead.
She read us stories, too, and made us clean our rooms. She even laughed at my father's stories from work. And she was very pretty,
he said.
I remember thinking as a little kid that I'd gotten the prettiest mom on the block.
She sounds wonderful.
Yeah,
he whispered softly.
She was. I remember her and Dad coming home from the hospital, sitting us down. I remember they were